Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of Cure Panel, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to Cure Panel's on-air Myeloma Support Group meeting. This is our live on-air support group meeting headed by myeloma survivor, author and advocate Pat Killingworth. Cure Panel's on-air myeloma support group meets every month on the Cure Panel Talk Show. And the show is broadcast live on Block Talk Radio. I'm excited to announce that it has been exactly 1 year since we began the support group. In this series, we have talked to doctors, legal experts, myeloma patients who have shared their story with us. And I, on behalf of the Cure Panel Talk Show team, would like to thank all our amazing members and participants for their support. Over the year, we have had more than 14,000 people listen to our support group meetings. At this time when we are talking about our support group completing a year, my thoughts and prayers are with Sandy Hirsch's family, who lost her this weekend to high-risk myeloma. Sandy was part of our first support group meeting in May 2013 and then again shared her story with us on this platform in March 2014. Sandy, you are in our thoughts. Today we have with us myeloma survivors and advocates Pat Killingworth and Paula Van Ripper. Gary Peterson would be joining us soon. Welcome to the show. We also have with us a very eminent guest, myeloma survivor and dentist, Dr. John Killip. Dr. John Killip has been a long-time leader in dental education and an advocate for strengthening effective teaching. Dr. Killip retired on December 1st, 2012 as Associate Dean for Student Programs, capping off a 45-year dental career, including over 25 years at the UMKC School of Dentistry. And he currently holds the academic rank of Clinical Professor Emeritus. Diagnosed with multiple myeloma, Dr. Killip has been treated at the Cancer University Medical Center Hospital Blood and Marrow Transplant Unit, the two autologous stem cell transplants. He is on maintenance therapy using Velcade and is currently in remission. Welcome to the show, Doctor. Today we are discussing osteonecrosis of jaw. This is a condition that is associated with the loss of blood supply to the jaw, causing the jawbone tissue to die. It can occur in multiple myeloma patients during treatment with bisphosphonates, such as Eridia and Zometa. I will now hand over to Pat to commence with the meeting. I would like to remind all our listeners that they can press 1 on their keypad to join the conversation and share their views, experiences with us, and ask Dr. Killip a question. Pat, over to you. You're live on air.
Thank you, Priya, and welcome, everybody. I'm just pulling into my driveway at home after racing across the state. My wife and I are moving from the west coast of Florida to the east coast of Florida. And this afternoon I had my first appointment with a new medical oncologist. And, of course, that ran extra long, as such appointments do. And so you get behind a couple trucks, and I think we all know the drill. So if you hear a little barking soon, that'll be because I'll walk into the house. And my dog will probably be excited to see me after spending a few days away getting the new house ready. We move on Thursday, and we're pretty excited. And Priya, I was glad to hear you mention Sandy, the loss of our good friend, dear friend Sandy Hirsch. And I also wanted to mention this was a rough month. Earlier in the month, I lost another prominent member, or we lost another member of our myeloma community, Carl Volstead, who started the Stillwater, Minnesota support group 10 years ago, and that group has well over 100 members. They get 40 or 50 people to attend each meeting, and Carl was a good friend. Not only was he a myeloma friend, but we became close personal friends, and he passed away at the beginning of the month. So, you know, it's been 7 years since I was diagnosed, and I feel like I'm maybe 76 or 78 years old, and I'm starting to outlive my friends. I think that's how it feels a little bit, but it's worth it. I can't think of more wonderful, caring, and brave people than those in our multiple myeloma community. So, but it doesn't mean that it's easy, and I guess those of us that are still here have to be thankful for that. And I'm especially thankful that we have John with us tonight. John, I know John, and he's a fellow myeloma patient, and also was a dentist. He's a retired dentist, and so I approached him about talking to us about osteonecrosis of the jaw, and he graciously agreed to join us. So John, if you're there, if you could tell us a little bit about your myeloma story, and maybe talk a little bit about OMG and how to avoid it and what to do about it.
Great, Pat. Thanks for the opportunity to spend a little time with you folks this afternoon. Thanks to you, Pat. And as Pat said, he and I have interacted on several occasions, and I hope that we have the opportunity to do it much more frequently in the future. And I would like to become one of Pat's myeloma friends beyond being just one of Pat's myeloma acquaintances.
You already are, John.
Well, good. I'm heading in the right direction. Thanks. I'm ready for the dogs to bark any time, and when they do, just bring on the dogs, and we'll slow down just a bit. My myeloma story began in 2007. I was diagnosed in October, had the normal panic time of trying to figure out what this disease was and the best opportunities for me to ensure that I continued with a long and active life style. At that point in time, I was fully employed, and I stayed fully employed, as Priya said, until December of 2012. I did the normal routine of lead-up preparation for a stem cell transplant through the months of November, December, January, February. Had my first round of high-dose chemotherapy on St. Patrick's Day in 2008, and my first transplant occurred 2 days after that. Recovery was good. I was back to work, beginning to go into work 30 days, a couple hours a day maybe, 45 days, a few more hours than that each day, and then by day 60, I was traveling to a board meeting in Washington, D.C., so I had a very good recovery. I remained very healthy on maintenance medications for 4.5 years, and then the myeloma bug started creeping back in, and I had a second transplant in October of 2011. Again, as I said, I worked full-time throughout that process and actually worked full-time until the week before my second transplant. And possibly I told you the wrong year of that second transplant. It was actually 2012 because, as I said, I worked right up until the time of that. And then after a couple months of recovery is when I retired. So it's been an interesting journey and one that's had its challenges, but in the long run, my wife and my family and I and my work colleagues and friends who have been very, very supportive have made it a very positive experience. So that's kind of my background, and here I am today in remission following that second stem cell transplant, and have been in remission since 100 days following the transplant. So I'm feeling the best at this point in time that I have felt in a long time. I am on Velcade every other week, sub-Q, and Thursday is my biweekly appointment for my Velcade. So things are going good, and I'm sure glad to be here.
Good to hear, John. Thanks.
Thanks, Pat. And let's do a little bit about bisphosphonate related osteonecrosis of the jaw. As Priya said in her lead-up comments, that's a circumstance that occurs in people who have had a past history or a current history of being on bisphosphonate therapies to strengthen their bone. And it can occur in people who have had osteonecrosis, for example, or those of us who are privileged to have multiple myeloma are people who have to be aware of this particular condition. Generally, it occurs in the mouth, most frequently toward the back of the mouth, and it's an area, as she said so well at the beginning of the program, where the blood supply becomes compromised and the soft tissue, our gum tissue, breaks down and no longer covers the surface of the bone. It's oftentimes, Pat mentioned that we'll talk a little bit about things that might bring it on. As we said, it's those having a long-term treatment with those bisphosphonate medications can bring it on spontaneously. But most often, there are some reasons that it happens. And those reasons generally are that there's been a dental procedure carried on in the area that the osteonecrosis occurs. And most frequently, that is an extraction of a tooth. Or it could be a denture that is irritating that particular area. It could also be a place where there has been a history of gum disease around a tooth. And perhaps that's the reason that the tooth had to be taken out to begin with. And then heavy smoking, patients who are diabetic, and then those of us who are over 65 are kind of the patients that it affects most frequently. And when I say most frequently, we have to keep in mind that in the general population who are taking those medications, the incidence of osteonecrosis of the jaw is below 1%. So it doesn't happen very often to people who are not affected by certain cancers. But we do see it occurring more frequently in people who are patients with three widely known cancers: multiple myeloma, breast cancer, and prostate cancer. And of concern to us with myeloma and of concern to our friends with myeloma, it occurs more frequently in myeloma patients than it does in those other two cancer patients. So I said initially that non-cancer patients, the risk was below 1%. In cancer patients, it can be between 3 and 12% of the patients who experience the challenges of osteonecrosis. So of concern, and this is kind of, I'm going to make this statement and then I'm going to stop and see what questions Pat might have or Priya might have or other questions that may be coming into us online. In the current literature, and I went back and did a literature review with the help of the librarian at our school, Marie Thompson, and also with the chair of our Department of Oral Pathology, Craig Witt. And I do want to say thanks to those folks for their help. But we did a literature search, a PubMed literature search, initially came up with 65 articles that related something to do with bisphosphonate osteonecrosis of the jaw. We began narrowing them down, and I really concentrated on only articles that are as recent as 2005. So I tried to get the most recent information to share with everybody. And I said I was going to stop talking, but I did want to go to the point that I was heading toward. That osteonecrosis, bisphosphonate-related osteonecrosis of the jaw is more prevalent in multiple myeloma patients as compared to breast and cancer patients. So, as I said earlier, that's why we're concerned with it as patients who have myeloma or friends of patients that have myeloma. Pat, have I raised any questions in your mind, or are there questions out there that I might be able to begin addressing at this point in time before we talk about how we take care of patients with this condition?
Well, I have several, John, but I've got to tell you that this is the dog barking portion of our broadcast.
Uh-oh, I don't hear him.
After 4 hours, I'm going to have to go to the bathroom here soon. So I'm in with the hello, Island Dog. Finnegan's excited. We call him Island Dog, and he's actually moving from an island. So, but I think what he'll really want is to be fed. So I'm just going to feed him real quick, and then we'll get on to Lizzie and see if
well,
he gets
let
a
me,
question.
Let me,
and I'll get back
I got
to
a couple.
You.
I got
come
a
on, bud.
Sounds like there are a couple coming in, a couple questions coming
Gary
in.
Gary Peterson, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Pat and I work together on, and Priya, on cure panel discussions, and sometimes I show up at these conversations as well. But one of the questions I had is I know part of it has to do with this bisphosphonates, but my question also has to do with just myeloma in general. Myeloma in general is a bone disease, correct?
Yes.
Your jaw is a bone also, I believe, right?
I think you're right.
Okay.
I'll agree that you're right, 100% right.
Okay, so do we just as myeloma patients, even without bisphosphonates, have a problem with our jaws? And the reason I ask is very selfish in nature, and that is that it just seems like my mouth went to hell when I got myeloma. I've lost 7 teeth. I never lost a tooth before in my life, you know. And then I got myeloma, and I'm losing a tooth a year. You know, I bite down on a salad and one breaks. I bite down on a pizza and one breaks. I have, it just goes on and on and on.
I have a couple responses or a couple thoughts related to your questions. If you had told me that your bone below your teeth was breaking down, then I would start being concerned, or I would start thinking, are you a guy that's having some of these lytic lesions that we get in myeloma in your jawbone?
Okay.
Most frequently they don't occur in the jawbone, but they can, and they do, and we know that they're there. But if you're telling me that you're biting on a pizza or biting on something else and your teeth are breaking, I'm more concerned with the teeth themselves. Generally, a tooth doesn't break unless there's been some sort of caries going on inside of it. So kind of moving your question or my answer away from your teeth breaking, I'm more concerned if you had told me or if a patient had told me that they were having gum problems, periodontal problems. And then I would start thinking that maybe it was more myeloma-related than general breakdown of the teeth.
Well, you know, one of the questions I was wondering as well is, you know, there's a, you know, what the makeup of your teeth, isn't it calcium? Isn't strong bones drink milk calcium? You know? whatever, I don't know, maybe it's a wives' tale. But, you know, in myeloma, we have the calcium is released from our bones. I don't know if it's released from our teeth as well.
Okay, I'm going to jump in with that old wives' tale that people used to say that each time a lady got pregnant, she would lose teeth because the calcium was being pulled from her teeth into her body to support that growing embryo.
Hmm.
And that, I've got to say, is not true. And I would also say that pulling calcium out of our teeth into our bones to possibly help strengthen our bones, that doesn't happen. The calcium in our teeth is bound up, and it doesn't go away back into our bloodstream.
Okay.
So that one, I got to debunk that old wives' tale on that one.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just curious. And, you know,
right.
Since, oh, it's a dental issues.
Yeah.
And I was thinking maybe it was the foundation of my teeth. You know, they all.
Well, see, you're saying that, and it also makes me go back. When I think of the foundation of the teeth, I'm thinking of the bone that's supporting the teeth.
As do
I. Just as a foundation that supports a house, and that's why my concern initially from your question was, if you were having trouble with your bone in your jaw and your teeth getting looser, then I would say I would be more concerned about the myeloma connection than the fact that your teeth are breaking.
Okay. Well, and also, and the other thing is, if I get any infection whatsoever, it just goes nuts.
Right. We've all got to be concerned with that. And one of the most important things, and the risk factors are, if we're not keeping our mouth especially clean and our dental care providers are not keeping up on what's going on in there, the gum disease or periodontitis is one of the reasons that teeth do become loose, and that's one of the reasons that they might have to be extracted. And then the next step might be the formation of osteonecrosis near that extraction site.
Okay. So
dental care and the quality of what's going on in our mouth is very important for all of us.
I guess one of my points would be on, you know, and I didn't, it seemed like if I would get a cavity, you know, it'd go to where you would end up having to have a root canal. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, but I also know that I'm 5,000 miles away and I really haven't seen what's going on in your mouth. So.
Oh, right. And for me, it was just knowledge and whether or not that's all part of the thing. And you're
right.
Saying, no, it's not all part of the thing.
Right. Yep.
Okay. Got it.
I have
a
question
for
John.
Is there anybody else
yes.
with us?
Can you hear me? Pat, this is Paula Van Riper.
Hi, Paula. I can hear you. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, I'm getting better. I had my own, a bit... As Pat says, it's been kind of a bad period of time. Well, I had a little bit bad period of time, but it's coming along. But I have a question for John. In fact, I've met you, John. We were at a support group leaders meeting a couple of years ago in Dallas, and I remember enjoying meeting you.
And I know exactly who you are.
Did you get your hair cut or something? You had some event going on?
I'm the one. Yep.
Yep. I kind of knew that. I kind of made that association. Well, anyway, sir, I've had myeloma for it's going to be 15 years. This August, and I've been on bifosphonate. I've been on Iridia for the first 5 years. That was when they thought you needed it every 6 weeks. So for 5 years, I had Iridia infusions, and then afterwards they realized that was too much. And then pretty much I never switched over to Zometa. I kept my Iridia, and now I definitely have bone involvement myeloma. I'd had compression fractures and lytic lesions and such. So really, the bisphosphonate is important to me. However, now we're at a juncture where, you know, even though I've maintained my dental hygiene as much as possible, I lost a crown a few months back and re-glued the crown, and it came off again. Why? Because my gum is basically receding. And now I have this portion of the molar in my jaw that needs to be extracted. So how long would you recommend that a patient, if they can, be off the bisphosphonates before a necessary extraction needed to be done?
Good question. Very, very relevant question, because bisphosphonates have a very, very long life in our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
They're not a drug that is taken one day and processed through our liver and all of that sort of stuff and eliminated quickly. Some of the literature says that you need to be off of the bisphosphonates for 3 months. But then there are other articles that say that being off of them much, much longer than 3 months is the necessary time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So initial advice is at least 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the advice that I really have is if you have to have that tooth taken out,
yes,
make mm-hmm. sure that the person who's doing it knows that you're a myeloma patient.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Knows that you've been on these medications for a long period of time and talks to you about what they anticipate the challenges of taking that tooth out might be. Because sometimes those will come out very, very easily and they're able to close over the gums and healing is very good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we want. Sometimes
yeah.
They're a little bit more difficult.
Well, unfortunately for my dentist's father has myeloma. So I'm in a unique position that my dentist not only knows about myeloma, but he stays up on it for very good reason from
How
a personal
wonderful.
Perspective.
That's
and
wonderful.
He also has an oral surgeon that he works with. So I'm in an enviable position that my dentist and even the oral surgeon is very familiar with not just my case, but myeloma in general and bisphosphonates and osteonecrosis. On the other hand, I'm also in a fortunate position because I had a root canal on that tooth, so I have no pain.
Right.
So I really could wait, and it's been more than 3 months now that I haven't had an Aridia treatment.
Yeah.
However, and I would love to wait 6 more months, but my bone issues really take precedent. And at
right.
the moment, my M-spike is going up, and so I'm having a discussion with my myeloma specialist tomorrow about new treatment. So,
right.
you know, it's like which is the higher priority here? And I don't think I should push the envelope much further because I think my bisphosphonates are a little bit more important at the moment. And so it's always like, damned if you do, damned
yep.
if you don't. You're not quite sure. But it seems that even within my group, this is a topic, extractions, and are they really necessary, and getting another opinion. You know, even if you stay up on your dental hygiene, as we get older, we're going to have issues. Most people will have some issues related to their teeth, whether it be receding gums
right.
or just like the previous caller said, he bit down on something and broke his tooth.
I think you are really in a very good place to be facing this challenge right now. Number one, you're going to talk with your myeloma specialist tomorrow or the next day and be sure and have that conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, the fact that your dentist is so involved and the oral surgeon is already involved in the process
mm-hmm.
because the skills that those people and knowledge that those people bring will be very supportive of you.
Mm-hmm.
And most
yeah.
likely you're going to go through that without any challenge at all. But myeloma patients of those three cancers that I mentioned earlier do have the problem more frequently than the other cancers. So you're thinking right, and I think you're going to ask the right questions in the next couple of days. And hopefully when I see you in Dallas in the summer,
That's
if
right.
we're both
there,
you can tell me about it.
I hope to see you there, and we'll have a reunion of sorts, and we'll share our stories. Thank you.
Yep, we'll do a follow-up. That would be great.
Sure. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
John, I have a question, although is Lizzie with us?
I missed the
very
start
of the broadcast. Maybe she's not. I guess that I'll take that as a no. John, I've been diagnosed with a vascular necrosis in my left hip, and it's been attributed to the dexamethasone that I've been taking on and off for now over 7 years. And can you tell us the difference? I mean, why does this seem to attack the jawbone versus other bones, and what's the difference between a vascular necrosis, say, in your hip or somewhere else, and in your jaw? They're similar, right? That means the bone is dying. Is that correct?
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure that I can divine a vascular necrosis as the bone dying. It seems to me that it's not getting a blood supply that it needed to be, and so it's not as strong as it was. And that's not something that I can really respond to immediately.
Well,
but,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
I'm just going to move beyond that, Pat.
good man.
I have tried, and I have asked the question multiple times with the experts that I have spoken with as to why this occurs more frequently in the jaw than it does in other places. And I've only found one article in the literature that talks about a young man in France who was experiencing what we call osteonecrosis, where the tissue over the bone breaks down and exposes the bone. I have come across one person in France who was experiencing that in his knee. But let's take it back to the mouth, because that's our question at this point in time. Think about all around our body and you and your leg, that surrounding that bone, you've got muscle, you've got skin, you've got nerves, you've got blood vessels, you've got all that stuff. And it's a very thick layer. But when you run your tongue across the inside of your lower jaw, for example, that tissue layer is very, very thin. There aren't muscles there. There are blood vessels, there are nerves, there's the layers of the skin and that sort of stuff. So that's an area that the covering of the bone is thinner. It's also an area where when you're chewing an unpopped piece of popcorn, that piece of popcorn can jump down there and scratch the tissue. It's also an area that just in eating and that sort of stuff, the tissue can be scratched. We don't know that scratching the tissue is one of the things that causes osteonecrosis, but I'm giving those examples because that's an area that is always being abused when we're eating and that sort of stuff. And it's also an area that has a history of when that tissue is broken during extractions and that sort of thing, that the problem with healing occurs. So thinking about where you're having this experience with your bone breaking down, it's covered with a lot of tissue as opposed to the areas in our mouth. And in my mind, of asking people and all this sort of stuff, nobody has a better explanation of why it occurs specifically in the jaw than what I've been able to come up with.
Sure, I guess sometimes stuff happens.
Yep.
To use the a more appropriate word.
Right.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. So, John, this is Gary Peterson again. So you have osteonecrosis of the jaw, let's say, and there you are. So what do you do? What does the doctor do? What does the doctor say?
What does the doctor say? What does the doctor do? There are very few things that can be done. What experience has shown us is if an oral surgeon or a dentist or an oral healthcare provider tries to go in, loosen up the edges of that tissue, pull it together, and suture it together like we might in another place in our skin that we have some problems going on with, that does not facilitate healing. Actually, the tissue that's been sutured together breaks down more rapidly than it would if it was left alone. The most important things to do are keeping things clean, having your dental care providers be aware of it happening, and helping you out to keep it clean. I wouldn't go in there with a tooth cleaning device and try to rattle around on that bone and keep things clean. But there are antibiotic rinses such as chlorhexidine that are helpful. Some people put patients on antibiotics to increase their resistance to infection occurring around that particular area. We want to make sure that there aren't any loose pieces of little bone fragments that may be a result of having that tooth extracted, or that there aren't any areas where, and I mentioned the popcorn hole or that sort of thing, areas where food has gotten into the area and is causing the problem. So it's time, it's patience, and it's keeping it clean. And there is just recently information, as early, recent as 2010, that the use of lasers to work on that area is beginning to be investigated, because there are some indications that laser may be helpful in getting that area to heal better. But again, the research on it is very, very early.
So what happens? You lose your teeth and you lose your bone, and so you just
generally it doesn't move to an adjacent tooth. It generally stays in one area. And if it's kept clean and using those chlorhexidine rinses and that sort of stuff, most people, it slowly heals up. But slowly is kind of the operative word. It takes a long time for those places to heal up. And if they are not kept clean, they can just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's when you ask, do you then lose adjacent teeth? That's not what we want to have happen, but if they're not kept clean and people are not on top of it, it can get worse.
So if it does, in fact, heal, let's call it heal.
Sure.
Can you then go in after that and have an implant or have
That's the question. You asked the question right off the bat. Those areas where that bone has healed or the tissue has closed over are not appropriate sites for an implant. And again, there have been some patients who have been tracked where implants have been placed after they've had an area of osteomyelitis. And most probably those were in the front of the mouth as opposed to the back of the mouth, because the patient wanted some front teeth. And those implants, the bone never healed around them correctly, and so areas where osteonecrosis has occurred is not an appropriate site to go back and put an implant in later.
John, if you have an extraction and you don't have osteonecrosis occur, is an implant an option, or is it still risky?
The question, as I heard it, is if you have to have a tooth extracted, and following extraction, you have a normal healing, and no osteonecrosis appears, more than likely you're very positively can move forward for an implant.
Good. John, do you have an opinion about Iridia versus Zometa?
That was a question that one of my support group leader or support group members asked me when I said that I was going to be talking about this. So I went out and very specifically looked for the answer to that question, so thanks for asking it.
Well, good. Yeah, I just wanted to have an appointment in the audience.
Yeah. And what I found is one article that was written in 2007, and it was a study of 80 patients with multiple myeloma and other malignancies where people had bisphosphonate-induced osteonecrosis of the jaw, that it was slightly, and I say slightly, in that group of 80 patients, slightly more than half of them had been on Zometa as opposed to Aridia.
So these were 80 patients that developed osteonecrosis and a
yes,
little
ma'am.
Over 50,
and they were multiple myeloma patients.
And myeloma patients, and a little over 50% of them had Zometa. So
had taken Zometa, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so we can almost, I mean, can I interpret that to mean it probably doesn't matter if you're on Aridia versus Zometa?
That's my feeling, that it was, you know, such a small difference that I couldn't say that one was more responsible than the other.
Yeah, you have then you have the other angle that there are some physicians who, myeloma experts even, that say that there may be a anti-myeloma effect with Zometa that doesn't occur with Aridia.
Right.
So then, you know, so you throw that into the mix, and now we're back to, well, I wonder if there's a difference, really, in the end, and which one would be better for me in the end. I just happened to have been on Aridia for all that time, and then there was a little question about, you know, a number of years back about whether there was more incidence of osteonecrosis with Zometa, so I never switched over.
Right.
But most of the people in my group who developed, who were diagnosed with myeloma in the last, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years, almost all of them are doing Zometa. They sometimes don't even know what Aridia is because it was never ever offered to them.
I was on Aridia for over 2 years, and at the two-year time period, I actually, since I had been reading about this stuff, I brought it up with my primary oncologist and said, you know, there's a lot of evidence that says that I should stop already at this point in time because going on beyond that initial two-year period seems to increase the percentage of osteonecrosis. But again, you know, I've been very lucky with all of my treatment, and also I think my oral health care is pretty darn good. And so, you know, I think it is. And so I keep on top of that. And so I have a minimum, you know, I've reduced some of those risk factors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Paula, if I may, I know that for a number of years, Mayo Clinic favored Aridia over Zometa because they felt the long infusion times that maybe it wasn't quite as strong and there was less risk of ONJ. Yes, you're right. I think most, you know, Zometa, it only takes a half an hour versus the 2 or 3 hours. And so I think, and Novartis is very powerful and has certainly pushed Zometa hard. And
it's much more expensive, too.
Exactly. I also wanted to mention that I think you're right, or John was right. Not only, you know, the 2 years where now the IMF's working group, the International Working Group, has said that recommended that patients drop down to every 3 months for their bisphosphonates, but I have seen curves at places like ASH and ASCO that show after 5 years that there is no there seems to be very little benefit of any kind. There certainly isn't an overall survival benefit at all. And so like a lot of these drugs, you know, the longer you live, the less difference they seem to make. So you could argue after all this time taking all of these bisphosphonates, you know, someone could argue that there's no benefit of any kind. So it's pretty controversial.
And as you say, Pat, in the IMF paper on the guidelines for bisphosphonate use, it does talk about outside of the preferred 2-year limit. So they're saying that 2 years is about the appropriate time.
But are they also saying that you after 2 years you shouldn't continue at all, or are they saying just drop down?
No, they're just recommending cut back, and of course it's always based on your doctor's recommendation.
Right.
But Paula, you're a 15-year survivor?
It's going to be 15 years in a couple months. You can imagine how much radio I've absorbed in my body.
You're a walk-in radio store.
I'm glowing. Like I said, I had a video every 6 weeks for the first 5 years that I was diagnosed. And after that, after that, it went to about 4 times a year, and now it's like 3 times a year. But I continue with the thought that I definitely have bony disease. And I was diagnosed with a plasmacytoma in my femur, and I had a compression fracture in L2, and I have another tumor in L3. So I want that bisphosphonate as a insurance policy, so to speak. Not so much to, it doesn't really have anything to do with your survival, but potentially it's your pain level. And when you do get a tumor, how much pain will you have? It's a lot more difficult for that lesion to develop into breaking that bone if potentially your bones are quite, stronger. But is there a limit? Maybe I reached my limit a long time ago, and now I'm just taking already every 3 years. For what purpose, I'm not sure.
Well, and Paula, you don't need to defend yourself, because, I've gone back to monthly. I have active lesions right now, and I've gone back to monthly infusions, Zometa infusions. But now I've only used Zometa for a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes a difference or not, the difference between Iridia and Zometa. But either way, I'm with you. I think it's worth, as long as I'm not showing any adverse side effects, it's worth trying to get some kind of benefit or improvement. So, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I was just making the point that for somebody who maybe doesn't have a bone involvement, you got to wonder at what point you just stop.
Yeah, and I'm a fortunate guy in that I have very, very few bone lesions. And on the skeletal scans that have been taken over the last 7 years, there's no evidence that they have gotten any bigger, and they are beginning to say that there's evidence that the skeletal lesions in the long bones of my leg are getting smaller. So I've been fortunate in that process,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not facing the challenges that some of our other patients are.
Yeah, you are fortunate. I have one more question. I have a member of my group. She's quite a fortunate woman. She was at the very first meeting of my support group in 2005, and at that point she was diagnosed and was very overwhelmed, like all of us are initially, and they said she was smoldering. Well, I want you to know that she is still a member of my group. She has not had treatment yet. She's still smoldering. Her disease hasn't really kind of gone up a little bit, down a little bit, but her local oncologist told her that she should probably be doing Iridia Zometa as a precaution, because eventually it's very possible she'll have bone disease. But her instinct was, no, I don't want to do that. And she has never had Iridia or Zometa. Would you agree with that oncologist that she should have it as a preventive if she's a smolderer? I mean, now you have the knowledge to know that it's been 9 years.
Right.
And she's kind of in the same boat. But I thought that was a little unusual that he would have recommended that. And periodically, she still sees him like 3 times a year, and a couple times a year he'll say, have you changed your mind yet?
She has.
What do you think?
The lady who's the head of our support group, who leads our support group, has been smoldering for like 16 years.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
So she's always kind of the hero. And
mm-hmm.
I'm real rapidly looking for, I had a reference somewhere, but I can't find it right this second, that says smoldering is not an indication to begin on a bisphosphonate.
That's good.
But,
okay.
You know, Paula, I can look further and give you that reference, but I'm not finding it right this second.
If you find it, that's fine. I think she has been comfortable with her decision all this time, and she has also gone for bone density tests to see if she's osteoporotic in any way or something like that, just to be safe. And, so she's just riding the wave, and I agree with her. She said, why should I take something if there's no indication that I'll really need it or will need it even in the near future?
Right.
So I think she has time. Yeah, I agree. John, this has been a wonderful discussion.
I've enjoyed it. And
yeah.
I hope some of the things I've shared have been helpful. Are there any...
One question,
yes.
John, that I have, and it kind of it works off of Paula's question, is recently, you know, and I've been now in CR for some 8 years. I've got my initial treatment at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Frankly, they saved my life. And then went on to, you know, go through the program in Little Rock with Bart Barlogi.
Mm-hmm.
But recently he suggested, because he noted my last time around I had a CT scan, but it was for bone density CT is what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time I think I've ever had that before. And something, they just recently got a new machine and started. And he said, I have osteopenia in my back. And he said that I should start with Zometa, a low dose of Zometa every, I think it's 3 months or something like that. And I haven't done it yet because I lost all these teeth, and I just recently had some implants put in. So how long should I wait, you know, since I've had my implants put in before I start the Zometa? I've been putting it off, you know, because I wanted to be able to eat again.
I don't know the answer to that. You certainly want to have all of the bone healing completed that it can possibly, can occur. And most likely your oral surgeon or the person, our periodontist who placed your implants, is the person to talk to about that.
Okay.
I don't have the answer at all on that one.
Is what they had said, but, you know,
I was talking and I heard talking over your answer, and I would like to hear what you said the time frame was.
I went to the University of Florida because they, you know, got a program there that does it far less expensive, and they, you know, who are kind of on top of it, said about 3 or 4 months, but I just kind of, you know, wanted to hear from you as well.
Off the top of my head, I would say 6.
Really? So a little bit more time than that.
And I know several people at the University of Florida Dental School, and they do a very nice job, those that I know. So
was
I bet
you're
in very good hands.
Was your doctor Siddhartha Ganguly?
Yep.
Is that the dude?
That's one of the ones, yeah. He's on our team at KU.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, like, he has got some of the best survival data, you know, in the world.
Yeah he's part of
great.
Our team. And actually, during my first transplant, he was the part of the portion of the team that was at the hospital every day that I was in the hospital. And he was the person who, after my second transplant, at I think it was my 100-day appointment, who told me that I was in remission. So, yeah, he's an important person to me.
Oh, he's remarkable. And he was he was one of the people that a number of other doctors said was just one of the best in the country.
I'm really pleased with the care that I've gotten at KU.
Yeah. Well, I've a little secret in the Midwest, isn't it?
Yep, it is. Mm-hmm. It is.
Thanks, John. How are we doing on time, everybody? I'm not wearing a watch.
My computer says it's 5:55.
Do you have anybody on dialing in?
Or 6:55, depending on where you are.
Right.
Rhea, is there anybody online?
Pat, I have a couple of questions that have been sent in via email, Dr. Kinnett. These are for you. I'll just read them. I think some of them have already answered through our discussion. Anyways, maybe we could just summarize it for these people. The first one says, what are some of the preventive measures that can reduce osteonecrosis of jaw in patients on Zometa?
The most important preventive measures are good oral hygiene. Make sure that that you're under care of a good oral health care provider team. And I see a line here on my paper that says maintain excellent oral hygiene. And avoid anything that would cause unnecessary extractions or invasive procedures where your gums have to be cut on. So good oral hygiene is really the most important.
Thank you, doctor. The next one is from a survivor who says, I'm taking Zometa and occasionally have minor bleeding gums if I don't floss daily. Trying to figure out if I should stop Zometa and if I may have signs of osteonecrosis of jaw.
I don't think Zometa is probably the cause of your bleeding gums. The patient mentioned if they're not flossing on a regular basis, then their gums begin bleeding. So that, again, points out the importance of maintaining really good oral hygiene. Make sure that you are cleaning your teeth appropriately and your oral health care providers are on top of it every day.
I think, Doctor, the third question also is, should have a similar answer. What are some of the factors which increase a risk of ONJ occurring in myeloma patients?
I had a hard time hearing that question. Could you repeat it?
Yeah, sure, definitely. What are some of the factors which increase a risk of osteonecrosis of jaw occurring in myeloma patients?
Significant factors that increase the risk of myeloma of osteonecrosis relate to the length of time you've been on the bisphosphonate. If there's recently been an invasive dental procedure, denture wearing, smoking, and being a patient who is diabetic in addition to their myeloma.
Thank you, Doctor. I guess we're almost over with our broadcast time. Dr. Kinnett, thank you so very much for joining us. Pat, Paula, and Gary, thank you very much. It was great to have you on the show. And since it's our first anniversary show, thank you so much, Pat, for having come up with the idea. And I think many people have benefited from these discussions and hope to keep going like this. Thank you, everyone. We look forward to having all of you join us again on the 27th of June at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. The Dr. Shaji Kumar of Mayo Clinic will be talking about interesting studies and results from the ASCO. For more details of upcoming shows, please mail me, priya@trilix.com, or visit our website, yourpanel.carefeed.net. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all the participants. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Priya, and thanks, everybody, for pitching in.
Thanks, Pat and Priya. I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Hey, thanks, Pat.
Thank you so much. Bye,
take care,
everyone.
Everybody.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.